Welcome to the Leadership Journey Podcast. My name is Alan Wilson, and I'm the host of the podcast. Each week, I'll be talking to various Christian leaders, discussing some of the things that have contributed to the story of their leadership, and at the same time, encouraging you to reflect on your own leadership journey. You can subscribe to the podcast via iTunes. Just look for the Leadership Journey Podcast, and while you're there, you can leave us a review. Meantime, enjoy the podcast. The guest on the podcast over the next couple of weeks is Trevor Ramsey. Trevor's the senior pastor of Newton Breeder Baptist Church in South Belfast. In the podcast, Trevor talks about coming to faith as a teenager. He talks about some of the early influences on him as a young Christian and about his decision to pursue his sense of call by God by resigning from his job to study at Belfast Bible College. He talks about his subsequent time as the pastor of Limerick Baptist Church in the Irish Republic, including what God taught him the evening none of the members of his congregation turned up for the evening service. Trevor, you're very welcome on the Leadership Podcast. Thanks for taking the time to join us on this.
Thanks, Alan. Yeah. Privileged to be here.
So, Trevor, you are the pastor of Newton Breeder Baptist. In fact, we're sitting in your office here in Newton Breeder Baptist. Tell us a little bit about the church and where it's situated and what goes on here.
Yeah, I'm the pastor here. He's been senior pastor since 2010. And the church was formed back in 1954. We're in the suburbs of Belfast. And way back then, in 1950s, the church in Hay Park Avenue on the Armour Road looked up the road and saw the new housing developments of the Four Winds and Newton Breeder and decided to do some gospel outreach there. And then eventually started meeting in a little room above a shop. And then moved to another building. So the church was formed in 1954, so it's about 64 years old, and only ever had five senior pastors in 64 years. So it's very, very stable church. It's always had good leadership. And today we've got about 440 members or so.
So we're one of the biggest churches in the Association of Baptist Churches in Ireland, I would think.
Probably, yeah. We've 440 members. We draw our members from all over this area and wider afield. We've just got a great location, and we've been able to minister to people from all sorts of places, and we've gradually built our staff team up. So today we've actually got 12 on the staff here in Newton Breeder, mixture of ministry staff and admin staff and ancillary staff.
So part of your work then is presumably leading that staff team?
Yes, that's become a large part of it now, directing the staff team and being able to provide some leadership to them.
It's interesting what you say about Hay Park, because I know the week that we're recording this, Hay Park has just become the home of a new church plant from the next 29 folk,
the village south.
But it's interesting to think that Hay Park, having basically planted here, then obviously went into decline, you know, in its own time, whereas Newton Breeder has really been thriving for quite a long time.
And those faithful folks back in the early 1950s, you know, sowed the seeds of what we have today, which is allows us to minister to hundreds of people on a weekly basis.
Okay, great. Well, we'll come back and talk some more about life in the church here and some of the the challenges of leadership, because I can't imagine it's all plain sailing leading a church with 440 members.
Right.
We'll be talking about deciding on the colour of the paintwork or something like that. let's go back. To early years. So tell us a little bit about just what are the key stages been of your leadership journey. Where did you grow up, and who were some of the early influences?
I grew up in a working class home in North Belfast. It was just a typical working class environment, and I was the oldest of four children. My dad worked in a builder's merchants behind the counter serving tiles to builders, and my mum was a stay-at-home mum, as all mums were in those days, and did the odd cleaning job to help make ends meet. There was very few Christian influences, really. We went along to a church occasionally. A Methodist church, we're in the BB, and all the usual things that we got up to.
You were sent off just before we started recording that. Same church, and I guess the same BB then, is Harold Miller. Miller, who's been on this podcast.
Yeah, originally it was Jenny Mount Methodist Church, which I think he mentioned.
And
We moved to Green Castle Methodist Church.
I think it was, maybe Green Castle. About Green Castle. Probably need to be to specify that you're a lot younger than Harold Miller.
A lot younger. I don't have the beard either.
I interrupted your story. So you're back, but you were saying that church influence was really more sporadic.
Yeah, you know, it was a cultural thing rather than a conviction thing to go to church. And we were sent along to the BB and brought along on Sundays and occasionally and went to BB Bible class and all that. And we moved out to Newton Abbey when I was about 16, and I came under the influence of a church in our area which was really thriving, called Abbots Cross Congregational Church. And in those days it was absolutely thriving, and lots of young people going there. And that
who was the minister there at the time?
Well, Sam Workman was the minister, right, and he had gone to that church, I think, in the mid-1960s when it was languishing, and 10 years later, in the mid-1970s, it was thriving. God had just done an amazing work there in that church. And I had an interesting experience. I was going to Belfast High School. That was the school I was in, and I was in my lower sixth year, and a friend of mine died on a motorcycle accident on a Sunday night, and his name was Trevor. And I was Trevor, and it made me think, if it was this Trevor, not that Trevor, who had died, where would it be? And I had no idea where it would be. And I discovered a little Gideon's New Testament that they had given to me in school.
In school, yeah.
And I dug it out and started to read it. And as I started to read it, things started to come alive to me. The Bible became real to me. And parallel with that was somebody that I'd known who had become a Christian, or as my family described it at the time, had become good living.
Yeah, that was the phrase, wasn't it?
And I was kind of interested to know what this was all about. I heard he went to this church. So what I did was, on Sunday nights, I would go and stand across the road from the church.
From Abbots Cross Congregation?
Yeah, under the shops, under the parapet of the shops, and watch everybody going in. And I'd go for a walk. It was summer. I'd go for a walk, and it was like wrestling with my conscience and soul. And I'd come back an hour later, and they'd all come back out again, or an hour and a half later, whatever it was. And then I would see all the young people from the church cross the car park and go into another hall. And I thought, why are they going into another hall? This was all new to me. I couldn't believe that, having been released from church, they were now going to something else. It turned out to be the youth fellowship. So after a few weeks, I plucked up the courage, went along.
On your own?
I phoned up this.
Right.
It was actually my cousin,
right,
whom I didn't know very well, but I heard he'd got good living. Can you bring me with you? And we went along. And I used to sit with them in the church, and they had a peculiar way of putting their knees on the pew in front of them, which I did. And because I did that, they thought I was a Christian. But
because of the way you put your knees on the pew.
Because you was doing the same thing that they were doing. I was trying to follow the norm. I didn't know what to do. And it came one night, and Sam Workman was preaching, and I knew I needed to get right with God. And I went to speak to him at the door, but there were so many people around him, I never could speak to him. In the end, I went to an open air meeting that some of the young people were doing, and I'm standing with the Christians singing. And God just said, "What are you doing here? You're not a Christian." And that night, I got into a mini car at the side of a road, and two guys got into the car with me and opened their New Testaments and showed me how to come to Christ. And that's the night I came to Christ. And I had the great privilege of going to see Sam Workman a few months before he died,
just to
thank him.
Oh, that's wonderful. Was that the first time he knew? Did he know that?
I think he had heard, but I'd never spoken.
Oh, really? Yeah. Right. Oh, it must have been wonderful for him to hear that.
Yeah. He actually was in the last month of his ministry in Abbots Cross. He was just finishing to go into itinerant evangelism. So it was the last few weeks he was there.
So that's in you're about 16, 17 at that point. Okay, and what happened next? Was there any sort of formal follow-up or what you'd call discipleship or anything like that?
I remember my cousin had said to me, "I'll meet you on Tuesday night for prayer," and he took me into a little flat that him and his girlfriend, soon to be wife, were in the process of acquiring, and we knelt on the floor and prayed, and then he brought me to the midweek meeting, and that was my pattern set. And then I got involved with Young Life and United Beach Missions, and then not long afterwards coming up on the year afterwards, I went to Queen's University, got involved in the Christian Union, and just started learning as I went.
Right. What did you do at Queen's? What was your subject?
Economics and accountancy.
Economics and accountancy.
Yeah, right. So I love it. I love economics and
that whole
stuff about macroeconomics and the state of the economy. Okay. And I still read about it and talk about it from time to time when I'm boring my friends.
Yeah. But Christian Union then, I mean, I know sometimes people who are in leadership now will look back to maybe university days, and those were some of the early pointers to, to leadership. Was there anything like that for you? Did you get involved in leadership?
Absolutely. I think that I recognised very early on, and some people had said to me, that university can either make you or break you.
Mm.
And it wasn't long into the university until I actually saw that. I saw some guys who professed to be Christians probably living in a way that didn't really honour the Lord. It was almost like they were released from some sort of stifling environment at home and gone to university and weren't able to cope with it. For me, it was a making experience. Mm-hmm. I was just a year a Christian, and I just loved the Lord and wanted everybody to know about him. And my first thought was, find the Christian Union, find where the Christians are. If they've got a Bible study, go. If they've got a fellowship night, go. And I started getting involved in that, and then in my second year, then I was asked to take on some leadership responsibilities. And alongside that, there was a group of us used to hang out together. And this sounds so archaic now, but we actually formed a little singing group. And we would go and sort of sing in churches and mission halls and on Sunday evenings.
Well, if it was nowadays, it would be a praise band. It would
be a praise band, but and we couldn't sing, probably, and we couldn't really do much, but it was like, what could we do for the Lord, you know, and this is something we could do, and it was quite contemporary in its day, I suppose, with guitars and things. And but what I noticed was that the guys would turn to me and say, you speak. And I went, why me? And they go, we don't know, but you speak, you seem to be able to do that. And so very early on, I got an opportunity to speak, and the first message I ever preached was from Ephesians chapter 5, I think, which was walk in love, walk in light, and walk in line. I thought that was a great outline from Ephesians chapter 5.
You still preach that today?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Do you still have the notes of it?
I don't think so. Probably burnt them or something.
Yeah, would you be embarrassed if somebody found a recording of it?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I know. I came across the notes the other day of, I think, the first thing that I ever preached.
Yeah.
It was probably around the same sort of era.
Yeah.
And I think that probably some of our old sermons we'd rather that they would be forgotten.
And I remember we went away for a weekend together, you know, just to hang out and do meal stuff, meal bonding. And we thought, what are we going to do on Sunday morning? Mm-hmm. Don't really want to go to church, you know? Mm-hmm. So we thought, we'll have a little sort of time together in the living room of the house we were staying in. And they said, you just bring a little devotional.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, okay. So there's a few wee things like that where God just seemed to be pushing me in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Were there any people particularly that you were looking up to at that point, or who were maybe taking a direct interest in, you know? You mentioned your cousin and the role that he had, but were there others that you began to come across?
I was introduced to the work of Young Life.
Yes.
And I was introduced to people like Verna Wright and Mike Barry, whose names I don't know how well they're known now, but
Verna's son is an elder here with
Verna's
grandsons on staff.
And grandsons are associate pastor. So the link continues. But Verna, as you know, was professor of rheumatology in Leeds University, and yet devoted his life to Christian service and mentoring young people. And though I didn't know him very well, just hearing his story was very profound. And Michael Barry was a lecturer in English at Queen's University. Right. And headed up the work of Young Life in Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. And just seeing how he was able to bring up a family, have a very important job in the university, and yet still have time to pour into the lives of others in Christian service, in a way influenced me. You know, they say that it's caught, not taught. I caught it. They didn't teach it. I just caught it.
I was just going to say that to you. How much of what you picked up from them was them sitting down in a formal setting with you and saying, I want to teach you this. And how much was just, you saw the integrity of these men.
It was the latter more than the former.
That's powerful, isn't it?
Yeah, it was the latter. And I just saw in them something that I thought I would like to be. There were other people as well. You know, I read the life story of Hudson Taylor, which had an incredibly profound effect on me.
A lot of people read the life story of Hudson Taylor in the 70s.
I know. It was one of those books that you were just given. And it just had a profound effect on me. And then the lives of some of the great, you know, heroes of the faith, like C.T. Studd, you know. And then Jim Elliot. I mean, that story gripped me as a young person. He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. Was incredibly powerful. So there were all these kind of influences on me. And I didn't realise it at the time. It's only when you look back on it, I think you see that this was shaping me.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, quite. What happened after Queen's?
After Queen's, I taught economics and...
In a school somewhere?
No, I went to FE College, which was called Castlereagh College of Further Education.
Yeah.
And then I went to University of Ulster for a short time to teach there, to lecture there in business studies, actually. And I was married then in 1980. I was just 23 when I was married to Sheila. I met Sheila at school, actually, and I thought she was an angel. I thought she was far too good for someone like me. And we married in 1980 and had our first child in 1982. But God had started to stir our hearts as a couple even before we got married, you know.
What do you mean by that? I mean, somebody listened and said, okay, that's a phrase that stirred your heart. Yeah. How did you know it was God? What did it feel like?
I suppose... And again, this sounds awfully old-fashioned. When I talk to young people in our church about this, it just seems so archaic. But before we started a relationship, we had several conversations with each other because we realised that relationships are serious. So they can only end in one of two ways, and that's either marriage or breakup.
Yeah.
And so we thought, we don't want either of those two options unless that's exactly what we want to do. So we had several conversations, and I was saying to her, look, I don't know what my life's going to look like in the long term, but God's doing something within me that's making me feel drawn towards what we call full-time vocational ministry.
Yeah.
And I said, so therefore, if you're going to marry me, you're not going to end up rich. You're not going to end up... No, I'm not going to be, in that sense, rich. But, and she was saying, well, God's working in my life as well, and I do sense that that's my life. And so that's what I meant, really. So before we even kind of formally started a relationship, we'd had those conversations so that by the time we formally started going out together, we kind of knew that God had brought us together.
Right, right, okay. That whole idea of a sense of call and the vocational ministry, what advice would you give to somebody who's wondering about that? You know, say someone at that stage of life.
Yeah, it's a great question and one that I've thought about a lot over many years. There is that stirring of the heart that's a work of the Spirit in your heart, which leads you to feel a sense of discomfort, I think. That's the first thing. A sense that there is something that God wants from my life and I need to find that. And then I think it's about talking to mentors, older people who know you. It's also about immersing yourself in Scripture and allowing God to speak to you clearly in Scripture and coming to Scripture without any agenda. You know, we're very good at coming to the Bible to find confirmation for what we've already decided to do. It's trying to have that indifference.
Right.
In a way.
Speak to me in whatever way you want.
I'm really open to anything. I'm really trying to be indifferent to my own will and committed to doing your will. And then it's a matter of looking at the circumstances of your life, your gifting, and seeing, is there something here that I can fit into? And it's not a road you want to go down unless you're 100% sure this is the way, walking in it.
So for you, it wasn't that there was some sort of a sense of, you know, people might say that they felt God wanted them to go to Africa or, you know, to go into training for a specific kind of ministry. Was it more general than that?
No, it was a specific idea. Yeah, it was a stirring towards mainland Europe, strangely, because I'd done French and German for A-level, and I don't know whether that kind of shaped something about an interest in the culture of mainland Europe. And I was drawn to the work of European Christian Mission, actually, and the realisation that mainland Europe largely didn't need schools or hospitals or medical care because that was pretty advanced. But what it needed was the gospel. Mm-hmm. Large parts of Europe had been untouched by the Reformation. Mm-hmm. And those were the stories that stirred my heart. It wasn't so much the Africa or the Asia or South America.
Yeah.
It wasn't the deepest jungles or the tribal work. It was cities in mainland Europe. And so that's what led me ultimately to resign my job and apply for Belfast Bible College with a sense that one day God would take us to mainland Europe. Mm-hmm. And then halfway through our Bible College course, a man came to our church one Sunday morning and he put up a map on the screen.
Were you settled in Abbott's Cross at this point?
No, we, after we had got married, we joined Monkstown Baptist Church.
Yeah, okay.
And actually, the day we got married and went off on our honeymoon, that evening was a church members meeting and our names were on the agenda for membership.
Yeah.
So the first Sunday we came back from our honeymoon,
we
came back into membership, which is what I would advise any young couple to do, is to settle that issue.
Mm-hmm.
Where's our church home going to be?
Mm-hmm.
It's really important. Many of them leave it too late and mm-hmm. suddenly realise they're 6 months or a year down the line.
Yeah.
They haven't found a church home and then they start to drift.
Yeah.
But that was a good pattern for us. Mm-hmm. And this man came to our church one Sunday morning, put a map on the screen of the Republic of Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, no, put a map on the screen of the whole of Ireland. And on that map were dots
mm-hmm.
for evangelical churches.
Mm-hmm.
And the north of Ireland, Northern Ireland, was covered in mm-hmm. dots. The Republic
like
of Ireland.
Measles.
Yeah, the Republic of Ireland had scattered dots.
Yeah.
No, so like God gripped our heart and said, that's where we want you to be.
Yeah.
And so after we finished Bible College, we applied to join Baptist Missions uh-huh. and ended up initially in Cork and then in the city of Limerick.
Right, let's just go back to BBC for a bit.
Okay.
We were there in the early 1980s. That,
Where
my wife was
your
there
wife
before
was there.
She was my wife.
Alan, And she's still your wife, isn't she?
She's still my wife. She's back working there again. Absolutely. What were some of the highlights of BBC then?
Oh, it's a much different college than it is today.
And absolutely.
The reason we applied to BBC was because it had been formed as a missionary training college.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what we were drawn to, and also the field term system they had.
Yeah, they were quite pioneering on that.
Very pioneering.
Days,
it was great.
Yeah.
And I just remember this diverse group of people and having to do the chores around the place and having to do the outreach teams, and we all had to spend an afternoon a week doing, you know, one afternoon I think we went to a nursing home and had to speak to, you know, 20 older folks having wee doze in the sunshine, and you just cut your teeth and all that sort of stuff. And then the field term took us to Austria
mm-hmm.
for 8 or 9 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
The second field term I ended up in Carrickfergus Baptist Church.
Mm-hmm.
The third field term I ended up in Limerick mm-hmm. Baptist Church,
mm-hmm.
which then God started to connect that with mm-hmm. the challenge that we'd heard that Sunday morning,
mm-hmm.
and we ended up then going to Limerick.
Okay, so you said you went to Cork first and then Limerick.
Yeah, it was part of our orientation, if you like, and there I met Ted Kelly, who had been the pastor of Cork Baptist Church, mm-hmm. and he was another big influencer on me.
How did he influence you?
It just felt like, for Ted, it was this love for God that was infectious,
mm-hmm.
and it was his desire to see churches planted
mm-hmm.
In County Cork and in other areas. So although the Cork Baptist Church was only about 50 or 60 members, mm-hmm. it had already planted another church,
mm-hmm.
and out of that has come 3 or 4 other churches mm-hmm. in the Cork and Kerry project.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
So how long were you there before you went to Limerick?
We were supposed to be there for a year, but mm-hmm. after 6 months, our daughter was about to start school and there was an opportunity to go to Limerick. And mm-hmm. so the mission leadership said, could we cut short your probation and mm-hmm. can you mm-hmm. go to Limerick? I think we had about 2 weeks' notice or something. So it all happened very quickly.
Yeah.
We ended up in Limerick at the start of September.
Did you go as the pastor of the church, or were you?
Yeah, well, Limerick Baptist Church was an old established church, but it was down to about 12 members. Mm-hmm. So effectively my role was just pastor of the church, care for the church, but also do evangelism. Mm-hmm. And we did everything. We had a complete blank piece of paper. Anything went. We did door-to-door visitation. We did open-air preaching. We did one-on-one Bible studies. I preached on Sundays. We did guest services, just whatever happened. And then during that time we were there, you know, I realized that the church needed a new building, and this was a complete new thing for me. How on earth do you take a small church, which was probably a couple of dozen members in those days, and start to think about building a new building? And just incredible story of God's provision and grace to be able to sell the old building, which had been 100 years there, which was draining a lot of finances just in maintaining all the usual stuff, and be able to find a site in the suburbs, and to be able to buy that site and be able to start to build a new building. And it turned out to be the first, I think it was the first Baptist church building built on a green field site in the Republic of Ireland for 100 years.
Wow, right, okay. Yeah,
and that building was opened in 1993. And this year I was back speaking at the 25th anniversary of that building.
Yeah, that's wonderful. It's great to get the opportunity to do something like that. Yeah. How long did you stay there then?
We were there for 8 years, right. Alan.
What were some of the big challenges of that?
Oh, man. Yeah, I went in 1986, and the church was small, and the city was huge, and just seeing the thousands of people pouring into the Catholic churches every weekend, and then seeing a handful of people coming to Limerick Baptist Church was just overwhelming. And the enemy used to use that against me a lot and say, what are you doing here? I remember one night turned up at the church, and this was a formative night for me, and nobody turned up for the evening service.
For Sunday night service? Yeah. Nobody turned up?
Nobody turned up. It was one of those Sundays where, you know, normally we would have had a nice wee group of 15 to 20. We would have sung and shared a word and enjoyed some fellowship together. But it was one of those Sundays where, on the Sunday morning, different folks were saying to me, Trevor, I'm sorry, we're not going to be out later on. And I was sitting on Sunday afternoon thinking, who's going to be there? Well, I had to turn up because I'm the pastor. So I turned up and put the lights on, and there's nobody there, not even the musicians, just me. And after about 20 minutes, I hoped nobody would turn up, because it's worse if one person turns.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I turned the lights off, turned the heat off, locked up the building, and I couldn't go home. I was so discouraged. And I drove out into the countryside and sat in a lay-by at the side of the road. And I remember saying, Lord, back in Belfast, there are churches with hundreds of people. Could you not have sent me a couple of dozen? And the Lord said to me, not in an audible voice, but I was totally convinced it was the voice of God, said to me, tonight I'm doing a work in you, and this is my purpose for this Sunday evening. And what I want to do in you is more important than what I want to do through you. And it was a very profound experience that really changed me a lot.
How did it change you?
I just think I realised that it's not about numbers, it's not about my agenda, it's not about going this Sunday and hoping there's another 3 people or 10 people in the congregation. It's God is sovereign in ministry, and his purpose for that Sunday night was to do ministry in me. And so he decided, for whatever reason, that nobody was going to come, but he was going to meet with me, and I was going to have an encounter with him. And that was his purpose. And I learned that actually every time we gather, it's God's sovereign purpose is what we want for that meeting.
Yeah.
Not what I might hope for or expect from it, what God has for me. And I went home. Sheila wasn't there because we just had our youngest child, so she was home with the baby. And she said to me, how many people were there tonight? And I said, 5. And she said, 5? Who were they? And I said, there was me, the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, and the devil. It was a very powerful night. I remember it very well.
Do you, I know that in here on a Sunday night, Brita, you're packed on a Sunday night.
Yeah.
Do you ever think back when you're down here and there's whatever number of hundred
people can fit in that auditorium. Do you ever think back to that night?
I do. Often.
Yeah.
I often think back to that night.
Do you ever wonder if God taught you a numbers lesson then so that you could handle the, in inverted commas, the success
of
the numbers here?
That's maybe very insightful, Alan. I think that's what he was doing. I think he was teaching me that what he wants to do in me is more significant than what he wants to do through me.
Mm-hmm.
He has to do it in me first
before
he can do anything at all through me. And the fact that he uses me or anybody in ministry, to me, is just an amazing thing. It's all of grace.
Yeah,
I still turn up on a Sunday occasionally and I'm amazed that anybody's here because it's a work of God's grace, isn't it?
Yeah, so that's been a powerful thing to stay with you.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. So 1993, was the building?
Yeah.
How long did you stay then beyond the building? Another three years or so?
No, we just stayed another year and a little bit. After that, it was very soon after the new building was built that I just had this profound sense, again, that I was in a transition. Now, looking back on it now, it's clearer now than it was at the time because there was a lot of wrestling and struggling with it. We were coming to a point where our oldest child was about to start sort of second level education.
Mm-hmm.
We realised that if she started that, we'd like her to continue that. So it was either another 6 or 7 years where we were, or maybe God had brought us to that point of transition. And there was one particular Sunday where I stood up to preach and I almost had this sense that the shutters were coming down.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember if it was around that time that I read Martin Lloyd-Jones talking about when he transitioned from South Wales, I think, to Westminster Chapel. And he talked about that experience where although the church was doing really well and God was using his ministry in South Wales, he had this sense of the shutters coming down. And that kind of resonated with me, and I just felt that. Now, it wasn't easy. We really struggled with it.
Mm-hmm.
And even after we left, we had a profound period of time of grief and loss and a sense of, had we done the right thing? Had we missed out on what God wanted us to do? And it was difficult. I'm not going to sit here and say, you know, oh yeah, we just knew God wanted us to leave when we left. I think looking back on it now, it was the right thing. But at the time, it was a wrestle for us.
Did you come to the conclusion it was time to leave before you knew what was going to be next?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we did.
And
with no idea what was next.
Okay.
Really.
Yeah. And was there an extended time of transition or a sort of, you know, almost a time of doing nothing?
No, there wasn't.
For a bit.
What happened was, and this is an interesting phase of my life, was that there was an organisation called Good News Broadcasting Association that was part of the Back to the
Derek
Bible.
Derek Stringer?
Yeah, as part of Back to the Bible network. It was Warren Wiersbe, Back to the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And they were developing their work in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looking for someone to sort of pioneer their work in Ireland. And it ticked a lot of boxes for me because it was like there was radio teaching combined with pioneering work in the Republic of Ireland. And as well as Northern Ireland, they were looking to develop prayer groups and prayer support and stuff. And several people said to me, do you know they're looking for something? This looks like a good fit for you. So I applied for that position, was interviewed, and then offered that position, and then was in that position for no more than 6 or 7 months. And for whatever reason, and I don't know whether I'm to blame for this, the finances of Good News Broadcasting Association, for the first time in their history, started to dip.
This is with an economics professor at the helm.
And so the council that I worked to in England then decided, actually, their regional work in Scotland, there was somebody in Scotland, there was somebody in Wales, and there was somebody in Northern Republic of Ireland and myself, that they could no longer afford to employ us.
Mm-hmm.
And so that came to an end. That was quite
6 or 7 months.
Profound, because I sort of felt the sense of God leading us into it. The interesting thing was that we had a commissioning service in the Iron Hall in Belfast for that, And that service was recorded. And at the end of the service, the guy who did the recording said, "Trevor, this has never happened to me in my entire life, but this service has not recorded." So there's never any record of that. Uh-huh. So I wonder what that's all about. So that came to an end for us.
So that meant then that having left the pastorate in Limerick,
yeah,
come into what you thought was this thing that God brought you to, what now? You find yourself with nothing?
That was a wilderness. Yeah, that was a time of waiting on God.
Okay.
Well, preaching around churches, doing youth weekends, whatever.
Were you still based in the Republic?
No, we were back in Northern Ireland.
Okay. So, interesting phrase, a time of wilderness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did it feel like wilderness?
It did feel like wilderness. It felt difficult. It felt like, God, why have you brought us to this place? And that's one of my learning experiences in leadership, is that God often brings us to those places where we have nothing except to depend on Him.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, that there's no formal ministry structure.
Yeah.
It's like, here I am, Lord. I'm available, but I don't know where to go.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what to do. I don't know how to feed my family. Mm-hmm. I'm dependent on you. I don't want to go back to the road you've taken me from, but at the same time, I need to know, Lord, I really, really need to know.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in that place for about 18 months, actually.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly, you may have read a book in the past, The Making of a Leader by Robert Clinton.
No, I haven't read that, but I've heard of it.
I think it's probably one of his students then wrote a book, picked up one of the themes that he talked about in that, and called her book Isolation, Shelley Trebesh. And she and Robert Clinton reckoned that maybe 90 to 95% of leaders go through what she called an isolation experience, which is the kind of thing that you've described. So she's written it's not a very long book, but it's a whole book that explores this in the lives of various people and what God's doing during that time.
Yeah. It wasn't inertia. Wilderness was not inertia.
Yeah.
I was still reasonably busy in a way.
Yeah,
I had opportunities to go to churches and speak and youth weekends and stuff like that. So I kind of felt it was really busy, but busy without a clearly defined ministry purpose.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to spend the rest of my life just filling a program in churches or whatever.
Yeah.
So that it was a wilderness, but not inertia. And we learned a lot of lessons.
Right, really. Give us one on.
Oh, one lesson would be that God doesn't owe you anything. I think you feel when you've left a really good job with security and payment and you go to serve God, you know, as people put it, in that way, that God owes us something.
Mm-hmm.
And the Lord kept saying, no, I don't really owe you anything. I can actually leave you in this wilderness if I want to, because you're not your own.
Mm-hmm.
You were bought with a price. And I own you.
Yeah.
And that's a scary thing.
Yes, it is.
To bow before the sovereignty of God in that way and say, Lord, I might just be in this wilderness forever. But if that's where you want me to be, I need to learn to yearn and pant and long for you in this wilderness.
Yeah. But the wilderness ended.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember it was actually a Jewish guy, a guide, when we were in Israel a few years ago, and raising the question, do you go into the wilderness to stay there, or do you go into the wilderness to come back? It's an interesting thing to look at biblically, even, you know.
Yeah.
Is the wilderness a place, I'm going to get out of this, you know, the hustle and bustle of this life and find this quiet place and stay there and never come back?
Yeah.
Or is the wilderness a place of preparation? And you go to the wilderness and then you come back and better prepared for what's next?
Well, for me, it was the latter.
Okay.
And, you know, my DNA is such that I like to be busy.
Yeah.
And I'm that choleric temperament that likes to be achieving things. And I'm not the phlegmatic or the melancholic that could sit in the corner with a mandolin and sing psalms all day. I needed to know that I was doing something that was useful.
Yeah.
So God brought us out of it.
Okay. Well, we're going to stop there for today. We'll come back next time and talk about what God brought you to. But thanks, Trevor, for what you shared about your story and some of those early lessons and those first stages of ministry. So thank you, and we'll talk again.
Thanks, Alan.
Well, thanks to Trevor for joining us on this week's episode of the Leadership Journey podcast. And thank you for listening. Trevor will be back next week to talk us through some more of his story, and he'll be sharing some key leadership lessons. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, have a good week and God bless you.